It's the Humboldt Chronicles.
I am the queen of everything. Gotta be high before I can sway. Light a tea and let it be. If you a viper.
I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. The Humboldt Chronicles is made possible by big thanks to Archaeological Research and Supply, Patrick Finnegan, CPA, The Humboldt Cure, and Eco Groovy Deals in Arcata. Today, part two of our look at this question. Why here? How did we get here in the first place? Humboldt, Mendocino, Trinity, we kind of know it as a regional community directly and in some places indirectly, impacted by the marijuana economy and culture. Last month, we paused our journey in the late 1970s. In this episode, we look at the 80s, 90s, and all the way up to today. We're going to be including your calls a little bit later at 707-786-5946, 786-5946. You can also email questions and comments to us at studio@humboldtchronicles.com. We're also going to be talking with Anna Hamilton, longtime resident of this area, activist and musician. First, though, why here, part two? I think you're going to recognize this sound.
The 1980s, you remember, that's when the sound of helicopters was drowning out your Devo, your Cyndi Lauper, and your Huey Lewis and the News.
That's the power of love. That's the power of love.
And any other 80s music that you no longer admit listening to, and when challenged on that, you say you somehow can't recall, for whatever reason.
The thing is that really camp, between 1983 and 1991 or so, really, before the Clinton administration, is when it was at its most intense.
That's Dr. Dominic Korva. He's the executive director of the Center for the Study of Cannabis Social Policy based in Seattle. In mentioning camp, he's of course referring to the campaign against marijuana planting.
So camp was a joint task force. It married national politics with local politics and state politics.
It was also during this time when Nancy Reagan weighed in on the issue, and although the phrase that became associated with her, just say no, had been around for a while already, it was in 1985 when she convened the First Ladies Conference in Washington, D.C., that the phrase really became hers.
Each of us has to put our principles and consciences on the line, whether in social settings or in the workplace, to set forth solid standards and stick to them. There's no moral middle ground. Indifference is not an option. We want you to help us create an outspoken intolerance for drug use. For the sake of our children, I implore each of you to be unyielding and inflexible in your opposition to drugs. Our young people are helping us lead the way. Not long ago in Oakland, California, I was asked by a group of children what to do if they were offered drugs. And I answered, just say no. Soon after that, those children in Oakland formed a Just Say No club. And now, there are over 10,000 such clubs all over the country.
Nancy Reagan, Just Say No, all the helicopters, growing up in southern Humboldt in the 80s and 90s, some of what Hezekiah Allen remembers.
I hear in broader American sort of mainstream culture, kids grow up in play cops and robbers, or, you know, maybe in some communities, cowboys and Indians, whatever. But, you know, we played grower and narc, or, you know, grower in camp, I think was the exact terminology. So it was very much a part of the culture growing up.
He's now the executive director of the California Growers Association based in Sacramento.
You know, I remember one summer, I guess it would have been 92 because it was the same year that we had the earthquakes. You know, there were four military helicopters, and one of them parks over the house and, you know, is hovering there. And, of course, we have scanner radios, so we can hear them talking. And, you know, my little brother, my mother, and myself, and Mom loads us into the car, and we're driving away, and we can hear them on the scanner. Oh, look, they're running. They must have something to hide, you know. Uh, Helicopter Bravo, follow them. And so one of the helicopters follows us up the hill, probably follows us for several miles, you know, while the other one's hovered over the house. And then the other one's sort of scouring the hillside around the house looking for products. So, you know, that was a pretty typical experience.
Dr. Korva looks at this period of time and sees it like this.
You know, in the 1990s, there was outdoor cannabis, but it was guerrilla grows, it was up trees, it was in the shade. It was all about hiding from the police, and there was a cultural effect as well. Because once law enforcement came around, you know, the culture of secrecy really developed. You know, you still had your communities and community events and people, but you wouldn't talk about it. And the children of the Basque language would be in school. And, like, you know, like, there was just no official recognition that this was even going on, which was not really all that healthy, necessarily. You know, for children to grow up kind of in fear of even talking about, you know, what it was that, you know, put food on the tables.
Hezekiah, having lived through it, of course, remembers it well, and points out that the community and citizens groups did come together to watch out for one another.
My family was not alone in being glued to the radio every morning, listening for that report of, you know, which way are the convoys headed. And sometimes, you know, having those few minutes of difference was enough time to, you know, I don't even quite know what the time was for, honestly, but it made us feel better, at least, to have that information network. And KMUD certainly, you know, Civil Liberties Monitoring Project definitely led the way in terms of helping to coalesce that awareness and that spirit of community.
Interestingly, looking forward, Hezekiah Allen sees the black market persisting and even flourishing, at least for a while, even after legalization.
There is both a regulated and an unregulated marketplace here in California. Our ability to transition the in-state marketplace is based on state policies. And frankly, at this point, it's based on how many retailers we have. And we have nowhere near enough retailers to sell all of the products that Californians want to consume to those Californians. So, yes, we will certainly have an unregulated marketplace that persists here in the state until such time as we have enough retailers to every person who wants to consume cannabis in California, which is now completely legal to do as of Jan 1st, needs to be able to buy that cannabis from a licensed retailer who bought it from a licensed grower. So that's one set of problems, and that's probably a 5 to 10 year problem in and of itself. And then the second larger problem is the out-of-state marketplace. There is no way that the state of California can regulate that. We don't have the authority to regulate interstate commerce. But there is still going to be lucrative out-of-state marketplaces, and California is still going to be a great place to grow cannabis with an existing community of people growing it. And so those challenges, I think, are likely to persist even much longer than the in-state challenge. And frankly, until we see meaningful reform at the federal level, I see no reason to believe that things are going to change significantly. Where there is a demand, there will be a supply, and Americans have made it quite clear that they want to consume cannabis and that they want to consume California cannabis, and even more specifically and relevantly to your listener base, that they want to consume cannabis coming out of the Emerald Triangle. You know, folks love Napa wine no matter where you go in the world, and the producers in your neck of the woods really share a similar similar space in the marketplace. And so it's not that the folks that are selling these products want to be criminals. It's that the marketplace just doesn't, you know, the market isn't regulated. And so they're going to continue doing what they're doing. The consumers still want the products, and the producers will still produce them for them.
We're joined now in the studio by Anna Hamilton, welcome, who has been here for a long time. I believe you said 1982 or so. And what you just heard there, Anna, Hezekiah Allen grew up in this area. Dr. Korva has made studies of this whole area, this whole topic that we're talking about. One of my questions for you is about the kids in the 80s and 90s, a lot of them were the kids of the people who came up here from San Francisco in the first place in the late 60s and 70s. And some of them stayed. Some of them left and came back. Some of them left and didn't come back. Dr. Korva made the point that although he doesn't know of a specific study, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence about some of the kids who came back, left and came back, mostly males. It was mostly females who decided not to come back. What have you seen? What's been your experience?
Well, first of all, let me just thank you for this program and for inviting me.
It's good to have you.
I am no longer involved. I don't smoke it. I don't want to smell it. I don't even want to almost think about it anymore because it's the world's problem, not mine. And I got interested in this because I had the wonderful platform of KMUD to do a talk show. And as I developed and found out what my interests were on this talk show, I realized that as a musician that had sung in Sheltico for 28 years, I'd become quite attached to these kids. Mm-hmm. And kind of, I don't have children. I've never had a real intimate bond with my neighbors because if you don't have children and you don't do the bus run and you don't co-parent and all of that stuff, you don't have that extended family. And they're really in a rural lifestyle isn't room for a third wheel. So,
but you were saying earlier before we went on the air that a lot of these kids who came back and who are now in their 30s and 40s have a real interesting take on the business side of this.
So my ability to participate was as a musician in the same gig in the same neighborhood. And so I got to meet people from all over Southern Humboldt who I thought knew each other, who didn't really, Salmon Creek and Alder Point and China Creek and Piercy, and they all came out to the Cove. So my experience of watching these kids grow up is why I got interested in talking about pot at all. The future seemed very shaky for them, and a lot of them were going through their money pretty fast. To get to your question, when I got here in 82, quite a few people had made a risk assessment of staying in Humboldt County and its impact on their children and were leaving.
Right.
So a lot of the people that I didn't meet were the first waivers who were very sound of mind and very skilled and had higher educations. Another thing I want to point out before we start is there were a lot of very well-educated people who arrived in this area in the very early 70s. They came straight out of universities. They had degrees. It wasn't just kids like me who were just bumping around trying to find out what to do next or who's doing what, so let's go over there. So watching this exodus of talent when I first got here and then seeing the kids grow up in this extremely stressful environment, and it wasn't very long before I started my conscious understanding of how I reacted to this took a real long time to develop. But now I realized I was concerned that these kids were being exposed to it, and as they got older and the mortality rates went up and the risk behavior became worse, I started to come up with some conclusions that there was a community that thrived. There's two basic personalities about risk. There's risk averse. I don't want any risk. I'm going to look at all the risks around me and make my choice. And there's the other that like to go on a zip line and bungee jump, and they thrive on risk. It's not a healthy or unhealthy thing. It's just a type. And I think there were a lot of people left in this community that really thrive on risk and thrive on it in a healthy way and an unhealthy way. So what I saw originally, because I'm playing as a musician and I'm out in the sort of street, so to speak, was I saw a lot of the at-risk population. I'd surf and I'd be down at the beach and I'd see a lot of the, you know, the real feral types, and, you know, I love those guys, my favorites. So, but what I didn't see, and what I came to see later through this What's After Pot movement that we're in now, is a lot of these people, women especially, came back to the community after getting an education to bring something back to a community that they grew up with. So my assessment is that more women came back mm-hmm. with educations and
to make a difference in the community where they grew up.
And I've seen several guys that went out to start college mm-hmm. and couldn't integrate well with a broader political social group and came back. And they had a lot of anger in themselves because, in a way, they kind of chickened out, and then that really made them angry about themselves. You know, they had no way to sort it out.
We're going to take a quick break, but we're going to continue on that, follow that line there in just a few minutes. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles, and a little bit later, we'll be glad to take your calls at 7865946. You can also email us with questions or comments at studio@humboldtchronicles.com. Back in just a minute.
Sorry to drift so firmly.
Welcome back to the Humboldt Chronicles. Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. We're joined in the studio by Anna Hamilton, and we'll be glad to take your phone calls at 707-786-5946, or you can email us at studio@humboldtchronicles.com. Anna, we were just talking before the break there about some of the folks who've come back to this area and so on. And I want to play a little bit more from Hezekiah Allen. And for those who are just joining us and may have missed it at the beginning of the show, he grew up in Humboldt and is now the executive director of the California Growers Association in Sacramento. Grew up in a family that wanted to be off the grid, that wanted to live that lifestyle. And here are some of his recollections.
The economic hardship was another component of it. You know, it took a lot to actually find the suspect, you know, especially back then. The farms didn't look like farms. You know, now you've got farms with greenhouses, and it's sort of more obvious. Back then, of course, it was harder to tie a specific plant to a specific homestead or person. And so it wasn't even always a person was gone, but the crop was. And, you know, then there was a family that couldn't pay their bills, and everybody had to, you know, we had food drives and tried to find them work and keep them on their feet. And so, you know, pretty significant arrests, convictions, but also financial and economic hardship as well. And, you know, back then it was a lot less about big profits than it was about subsistence. And, you know, my parents, they wanted to live off the grid. They wanted to live that lifestyle, and cannabis was a way that they could do that.
And you were in that area from 82 on. Why did you come to this area? And how did you, what's your story? Why did you decide this area? Why here? Why here for you?
I was working full time in the anti-nuclear movement in Orange County, California, when unbeknownst to us at the time, there was State Attorney General George Duke Majan instigated a COINTELPRO program against progressive organizations in Orange County and Los Angeles County. We joined a class action lawsuit with 60 organizations, and I didn't know it at the time. I mean, I remember voting to do it, but I didn't understand what it was. And we went from this joyous organization to a lot of, you know, tension and anxiety, and I had basically had a nervous breakdown. And as we were collapsing, one of the members said, "Hey, well, I own property up in Humboldt. Let's take a vacation. You guys need a break." So we came up here and you know, went back after a couple of weeks, and within several months, I basically just flipped out and got in my car and drove up here. And I don't know how I found my way up Elk Ridge to a progressive land trust where they were all political. They'd been in the Peace Corps. They were all educated. And I just thought I found my peers there, and I did find my peers there. But we had culture interrupt us. Mm-hmm. With camp, because mm-hmm. basically as soon as I got there, camp started.
And Duke Majan was still around for a long time.
We won 60 groups representing millions of progressive interests in Southern California you know, we were awarded $12,000, but six cops had basically spread fear and loathing. I say at every organization here, when you start going south, sit down and watch who's still standing up and get up and leave them.
Don't you think a lot of the people, I mean, a lot of the people I know, and I've been here for over 20 years, I think what you said there is that you thought you found your peers. I think that that is a commonality. I think that there are a lot of people who would answer the question I asked you in very much the same way, that they were looking for like-minded people, people who were interested in the same kind of lifestyles. And
I would
it's difficult.
Say,
go ahead.
I would say more than all of those things, because none of those were articulated in my mind. They were just smart.
But you felt that, though, or at least looking back, you
no,
see.
It was snap. They had smarts. They were smart mm-hmm. people. They had high
right.
IQs. It wasn't just, oh, man, let's go hang out and go to the Rainbow Bend, you know, thing.
No,
no, it was because they were smart, and they built stuff to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
A credit union.
Yeah.
The radio station, the health center, which is
right.
the largest Medi-Cal provider in the region.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
The
community center, but the things that have to interface with the feds, like the credit union,
mm-hmm.
that shows some smarts. And it was built with grants and people that could write them.
Right, which is a skill in itself.
Yeah, and I call those guys a senior class.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, I can think of, for example, writers and poets in this area who have expressed the same kind of thing. Very well-educated people, very articulate, good at what they do. And they've come up here in this, you know, this area speaks to me. There's a sense of place here, some of them have said. And let's see what this area has to say to me. And there are a lot of people like that. And that had a lot to do, I think, with the coalescing of the community here. Even though there were, you know, the pot economy, obviously, difficult to deal with when you're talking about laws and regulations. But still, people coalescing in a community here because they found what they think that they're looking for. Or at least, go ahead.
All of us that came up here or running from or toward something.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of us were running away, and a lot of us had an idea. Now, I was running away, and I ran into the people with the ideas who came first.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my group represents a bunch of followers. We didn't follow them up here, but somehow we got just a glimmer of it. I saw I was here for a couple of weeks, and I was had so much pressure down there that I ran away, and I came here because it seemed like the only choice I had.
So you felt something when you got here?
Yeah,
that
I felt like I could run up here for some reason. I don't understand mm-hmm. exactly mm-hmm. why, but I felt like I could run back up here. It's big. It was a lot of space, and
yep.
there was, you know. It wasn't like I had no desire to run away to a city. I wanted to run away from that kind of, that's a frightening place, a city. You know,
well,
you can get raped again anywhere down there, you know.
And, you know, when we talked in part one of this look at why here, we heard a lot of people in from about 1967 and 68 in the Bay Area saying, you know, we have some good ideas. We know what we want. We felt that for a little while there. But then things got kind of sideways in San Francisco.
Yeah,
there was
violence.
Exactly. And they said, we don't want to give up our ideas and our values, but it's just not working right here in this urban area. So we're going to go somewhere else. And some went to Sonoma and Mendocino and even Southern Oregon. But a lot of them ended up here.
And back to the land movement in a desire to escape to a place where they could express their values and create their own society. They were looking for cheap and remote landscapes to land on.
Yeah.
And in Southern Humboldt, when they hit Garberville, they ran into Bob McKee, who owned the lumber company. And Bob must have had a great sense of humor, because the hippies were not welcomed when they first got
right.
there. But Bob must have had a sense of opportunity, a sense of humor, because he sold 10-acre parcels for $5,000, a handshake, and $50. Mm-hmm. And I know people that bought their land. They had a small stipend from the government, and they had food stamps and stuff, which they really needed. A lot of them had babies. And they paid their land, their $50 land payment. I would have never been that creative. First of all, you mean you could get my
Yeah, $50. Well, speaking of finance, were you aware during those days when you got up here, I believe you said 82 or so, when, and as Dr. Corvus said, camp was at its height between 83 and about 91 or so, were you aware of people who got wiped out because of camp in your community?
So when I ran away, I drove up here, and it was in October, I just drove right up to the place somehow up Sealy Creek Road, which was about to be closed because it would close every winter because there would be a giant landslide. I drove through the landslide, had no idea what I was doing, and I didn't have two-wheel drive. And I get up there, and I had driven too far, and I ended up right in the driveway, which no one ever drove to because they were supposed to park on the saddle. And out of the bushes, one of the guys that I met on my vacation comes along, and he's pulling like an 18-foot-long marijuana plant. And it was the first time I'd ever seen a full-grown marijuana plant. And I get out of my car and say, "Hi, so-and-so. Hey, that thing's getting mud on it. You need some help?" And he goes, "Yeah, you want to help me?" And that was the beginning of my career.
Uh-huh.
And I got a clipping job. And the second clipping job I got was with 30 women. A guy hired women because they were easier to handle, and he had a big Visqueen greenhouse, and we were clipping weed in there when camp came. And so 30 women and all of the grower guys and the diggers and the processor guys and the owner and all that, we all had a run. Well, nobody could bring their cars up because nobody wanted cars on the property. It's a dead giveaway to the cops, and it's also the neighbors hate it because all the traffic on the roads. And then the guys take their money down to the city and get drunk and don't come back. So we didn't get paid, and we couldn't have our car. So I got a ride with about 15 people on the frame, nothing but steering wheel, engine, and four tires and a frame of a power wagon down Elk Ridge Road, picking up hippie trimmers as we jumped out of the bushes and jumped onto this
running from camp.
And then we got down to the bottom of the road, and the classic cluster of all the neighbors down at the bottom of each dirt road. And as you drove to town, you'd come down to the different creeks where they met the road, and you'd see these clusters of people at the dirt road turnouts. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of law enforcement, I've got another clip that I'd like to play from Hezekiah Allen, where he's remembering the whole camp scene. And
it was bad, man.
And local law enforcement, and we're going to listen to that right now.
Of course, the last element of it that I've really noticed the change in my lifespan is, you know, back then, somebody would break into your home with an assault rifle, tie you up, and take everything you had, and you would, you know, grin and bear it and pick your head up, and now we can call the sheriff. Like, you know, back then, the violent crime that happened within the grower community was largely unreported, and there wasn't a lot we could do about it, and so we lived in fear of that more nefarious criminal element as well, because we didn't have law enforcement or the rest of civil society to rely on when those types of crimes took place, because the judicial system viewed what we were doing as equivalently bad to what these violent criminals were doing.
So you're in a situation there where you have somebody, as Hezekiah was saying, somebody has broken in. Maybe they're armed, maybe they're not. Not much you can do at that point. What's your experience there?
Well, thank God, none. But I know several people, including a woman who was duct taped, you know, terrified. And it leads me to my favorite topic, which is, although we've progressed to this place where environmental crimes are now being chased down by the cops instead of the plants, which is as it should be and as it should have always been, the social costs of the drug war are being unaddressed in the affected populations, and it's multi-generational. These effects don't go away, and this alienation is hard on our culture. and I call it drug war post-traumatic stress, and I brought it up at one of the university forums, and everyone was focused on the environment, and I was so happy about it, but nobody gave a damn about these people who lived through it. It was, you play, you pay, too bad, you know. And the alienation, the lack of access to social services because they don't trust government, the idea that all government is bad and Democrats and Republicans are the same, I don't vote, what's the point? Mm-hmm. This nihilism mm-hmm. is really hard on a culture that was one of the biggest dreaming, visionary populations in the history of the world since the Greeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because in our conversations with both Dr. Korva and with Hezekiah Allen, they both, in different terms, but brought up the same thing, that and not to diminish PTSD among those who have served overseas or whatever, but it is a similar kind of reaction.
That's right.
And in fact, I believe it was Hezekiah who mentioned at one point where at the height of camp, it was almost like a war zone in some places, not all the places, but in some places. And so it is a real thing that you're talking about, where people had to go through that. And as you say, with some people, it doesn't go away.
Well, listen, if you've lost someone close to you and you've grieved and you know that grieving is like a sickness and you feel sick, mm-hmm. well, this fear and this trauma has that same lasting feeling. It's like, hey, man, no aspirin works, no ibuprofen works, drugs and alcohol are used to numb it, and just you tough it out, hey, man, stiff upper lip and all that jazz, and it has costs like, you get into domestic violence and whatever, and people being bullies on the top of the hill. And there's a whole bully culture down there. There's always some jerk at the top of the hill with more guns and a bigger attitude. And they always think because they're at the end of the road, they're the top of the world. And like, screw you, buddy. No, the trauma is real, man. Hey, I'm a woman. I'm one of those yes people. And me too, people. But the thing that really, really hurt me was the stress of this drug war. It almost killed me. I mean, I remember running away, trying to stay low, trying to stay in the bushes, crouching and running. Now, that's not easy to do. I was like, is my knee going to blow out first, or am I going to have a heart attack?
Sounds like a battlefield that you're describing.
42 years old, or 40 or something like that. 38, years old, healthy. And then I had to move, and they were busting a guy a few years later in this, and there's 5 days of DEA, Met Camp, FBI, ATF, IRS, and they're all there for 5 days on this guy's property, which is next to where I was renting. And, I got to go to work every day past these guys. Got to have a job as well as a little crop. And I have to drive through this every day, and they look at my car, and then I'm wondering, are they coming for me?
You don't know.
No, you don't know. And for that five-year investigation, a C-130 once a year would fly a grid over our place. Yeah. So slow that it would rattle the house for several minutes before it came into view. The spice shelf would shake. And then it'd go by. How can you drive that thing at 30 miles an hour? You could see all the satellite dishes. It was when they first started using radar before the lawsuit, and they couldn't do it anymore to see the grow lights and stuff. No, and one day I'm hanging my clothes on my lawn, and I could swear to God, I had the feeling that some guy was looking at a map, tapping on a map, and it was right on the top of my head. And later, when all this bus went down, I realized that was real. They were tapping on a topo map right on my property.
How long? Well, first, maybe you're still dealing, but how did you deal
he
with that
10
over
years.
Time? But how did you deal with that trauma? Because what you're describing is a trauma. How have you dealt with it over time?
It was just one more. It was a continuity. It wasn't like a trauma. It was all the time, man. Well, I just kept working harder. Like, I got on a board and I worked real hard on that, and I flipped out and had a breakdown, and that all was really south. And then I worked with the lawsuit on that, and that was really stressful, and got really stressed out and just kept working more. And then I built a house for somebody, and then that was even more stress. And
You just kept going.
Bear down harder. Right. You know how everybody knows how that is. You bear down, and you think, if I just bear down hard enough, I can get through this. And
you power through it.
Yeah, well, you don't. Yeah. You have a nervous breakdown.
But it's still going to be there.
After I took care of my mother, and she dies at 94 and has dementia, I took that year, and that's a year I just bent it into the phone, and I called every single agency in the county about, do you know the economic impacts of legalization of marijuana? And that's how the What's After Pot thing got out, because I was expressing the stress, and I was speed rapping like this to these secretaries. Hey, do you understand the impact of the legalization on the tax base and this property base of and they'd go, I don't know. Click. About the fourth call, he'll talk with you now. No, man, you know, you just drive yourself until you're crazy, or take drugs, or, you know, find a medication. I have an antidepressant. Works really good. I'm very lucky.
We're going to take a quick break here. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. We're going to take some of your phone calls, and I see some emails here as well. 707-786-5946, 786-5946, or studio at humboldtchronicles.com. Back in just a minute. Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask, and joining us in the studio is Anna Hamilton, longtime resident of this area. And we'd like to include your phone calls or emails. You can reach us by phone at 786-5946, 786-5946, or at email studio at humboldtchronicles.com. Anna, we've been talking a lot about the 80s, 90s, and up to today, and both of you and I have been here a long time now. We're looking a little bit ahead. On January 1st, there's going to be some sort of state legalization. Of course, we don't know if there will or won't be any movement federally. But what we do know is that something's going to change on January the 1st. And so I'm curious about your thoughts on the community. The community of Humboldt, Mendocino, Trinity, that has dealt with this for so many years, and now there's going to be some sort of a change. We don't know what it's going to be. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I'm out of the business, and as a person who rented, I have no clout. I have no investment. I don't grow anymore. But I am very proud of the way people have taken on the responsibility and struggle to create a coherent approach to this in the face of things like the federal West Coast Attorney General sending a letter to the supervisors threatening to sue them if they pursued facilitating the growing and zoning of marijuana. And when you have your community, including your government, say, oh, let's help you, we'll do this, and then the feds come in and threaten to sue Mark Lovelace and all those guys, you know, there. So anyway, I'm just real proud of the way people have stepped up to the plate. And
well, it's an interesting point, and it is true that with the current administration in Washington, who seem to be not real thrilled about what's going on in the various states.
And you guys said Republicans and Democrats are the same. Well, eat it.
Yeah, I didn't say that, but I'm sure somebody did. But here's another way to look at that. I think that given the heft of California, I think California can move forward on this however California wants to. And it's going to be difficult for Mr. Sessions and Mr. Trump to do a whole lot about it. Go ahead.
Did you ever wonder why California wasn't first and why Colorado was? Did you ever wonder why Humboldt County didn't lead the state of California in legislative ideas and initiative?
Go ahead.
because of what I told you, drug war post-traumatic stress, it's affected everyone. It's affected people who never grew. Mm-hmm. They ended up in this mess, deep in it. They ended up believing stuff that wasn't true, or they ended up finding out that all of their nephews grow, and now they've got children, and everybody's really okay, and there's not that much wrong with it. And if, you know, the county is traumatized. The police are traumatized. When I interviewed Mike Downey when he ran for sheriff, and one, I said, Mike, how do you feel about this? We used to run from you, and now we voted for you. And he said, well, it took me a long time to get my head wrapped around that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those police had to come to terms with the real community they were living in. He said, I have 9 grandchildren that live mm-hmm. in Southern Humboldt. Mm-hmm. I got to live here.
Yeah.
I know who the bad guys are. And they're all traumatized just like the hippies.
We've got an email here from Hector in Wyatt. Do you think that legalization will go a long way towards relieving drug war post-traumatic stress syndrome?
No, because people that I know are still probably participating a lot in the black market. The people that I'm thinking of, they've collected together over the years, and they've amassed large amounts of property, and they're growing millions of dollars with the weed, and they're not going to stop, because now you have, and when you grow millions of dollars with a bunch of people, the overhead is stupendous. So if the guy goes home with $500,000 or $3 million or whatever, it isn't, you know, you spend as much as you make. And I don't know where they put their money, but I bet there isn't a lot left over, at least not with the younger generation.
Well, we have been told by just about everybody we've talked to on this that there is a thought that the black market is going to continue no matter what.
Yeah.
The question is for how long and you know, at what pace,
how long did the revenue send, you know?
It's interesting you ask. We checked on that a while back. And in places like Southwest Virginia, and Northwest North Carolina, Eastern Tennessee, right after Prohibition, the moonshiners had a little bit of a gold rush there for several years. And the reason is that for the first time, their moonshine was a good deal because of all the taxes that had been levied then on the other hooch, right? You see where I'm going here. So for several years, they were making lots of money even after the end of Prohibition. The difference was, instead of running from the county sheriff at that time, they were running from the tax man. Because
I'm the tax man.
That's
hey,
right.
I'd like to remind everybody, please call in at 786-5946 if you have something to say about this. We'd like to hear what you think the future is for Humboldt County.
The other thing on the black market is that we keep hearing different kinds of estimates about how many people are actually going to go through the permitting, the legalization process. It's difficult to know, of course, what percentage that's going to be. Some will and some won't.
Well, you looked at the giant pressure it put on our infrastructure to process it through the planning department. So when you're looking at all these different agencies that don't exist, and we first addressed this with What's After Pot, the Farm Bureau came to a meeting, and you know, one of the guys was saying, you know, we would be interested in facilitating some of this, transactions, and you have to build infrastructure to handle all this stuff. And my question is, we're still looking at it like wine and alcohol, and I'm thinking it's more like tobacco. My main interest for the future is protecting the market and building up the marketplace and protecting outdoor growers, and the state of California recognizing that an indoor growing has a tremendous energy footprint, and it's absolutely stupid to grow marijuana on this scale and permit indoor grows first in this process. It's just like China gets into the industrial age, and the first thing we do is sell them cars, and now they got freeways, and now they're having the worst smog in the world. Why do we have to start this brand new industry off on the absolute wrong foot?
And what's the solution?
There isn't one, because people are like, People are no damn good. No, no, that's not it. What is the solution? You're the smart guy. Come on,
well,
tell us.
A lot of people are working on it. You're right. There needs to be an infrastructure first. And
why didn't we do it first? Because we had drug war, post-traumatic stress in our infrastructures and in our whole society up here in Humboldt County. When we came up with the idea as a group in What's After Pot that it was going to be Appalachian or Appalachia, that we needed to brand the Humboldt stuff for, and that the county had an interest in protecting the name Humboldt County, which they've now addressed several years later. In 5 years, they took that challenge on to say we could sue somebody for saying this was going in Humboldt when it's not. But that's how slow it's going to be. And, you know, there's just the ones that are going to set the laws are going to be the ones who are most rapacious and have the most to gain. And the ones that are sitting by like us with the best intentions are just going to watch this thing go by because we are not aggressive enough. We're not psychotic enough. We're not sociopathic enough to be as aggressive as it takes to win in a marketplace this big. It's going to be kick-ass, monster guys that get it. And I don't even care about big tobacco. Everybody immediately derails the conversation. They're going to grow it in the fields and they're going to grow it on the mountains and they're going to grow it on the boats and they're going to buy. No, I don't care what they do. I care what happens to the people that I know that had a beautiful Appalachian grown in a specific microclimate that's now all screwed up, by the way, from your diesel grows and your damn, pardon me, never mind. So forget it. So you know what the answer is? You tell me.
Well, a lot of people are looking at it this way, that maybe there's an analogy here to draw between what has gone on with craft breweries, for example. Small, locally owned, that do a really good job of what they're doing at a really good price, and they do it right with concern for the local economy, environment, and the local community, and they compete against people like Anheuser-Busch and Miller and so on.
And first of all, everything that you guys imagine will happen. And all the good ideas about Appalachian will happen. And the value-added marketplace will continue to exist. And it's well-worn now with the organic movement. And it will certainly happen. But what will also happen is everything else. And how quickly does the market respond? And the environment has changed so much from the growth of the population and the growth of the consumption of water and resources on the landscape that we no longer have the base, the resource base that we had before, especially in regards to water. So the possibilities, basically we used it up. And now we're looking at all the regulations about controlling water and where do you get it and how much you use. And now you got to know, and now it's pretty soon you got to pay. And everybody's all upset. It takes generations for people to get over their assumptions about what they can and can't do and how they're going to get into this new world they're living in. And basically, people age out of developing markets. Most people don't grow into it. They age out. Like, I'm going to be 70 years old. I'm done. I'm not going to try and figure this out. Yeah.
But you would have a lot to contribute, though, based on you being here for a long time.
No, because I see other people that are better communicators and better with people on a one-on-one and on a group level. I'm very much a loner, and my inspiration came through, I think I channeled Dr. Courtney or something. I didn't come up all of this. I got a download. One day, it popped into my head, and it was a summation of all I had seen.
Well, it's a complicated dilemma, that's for sure. How do you see the community changing after January 1st when there are going to be, a new business and industry built around this plant?
I don't see any big change because everybody's acting like it's already legal anyway. I mean, I don't know how it's going to affect the businesses because I'm not in business.
Well, it could, in fact, depending upon who's getting permitted right now and exactly what they're going to be doing. So presumably, somebody who wants to develop this business. And it's coming from Humboldt, and they can market it here and outside of this area.
Yeah, being able to market outside, being able to transport it on federal highways, mm-hmm. is a big issue. They're just talking about, do we have a caller, Larry?
Just go ahead and finish your thought there.
Well, they're talking about Brinks trucks, and I originally realized that you're going to need branded trucks with security to transport the money and the product, just like you do with until the value goes down enough. I mean, mm-hmm. You got a beer truck. People don't heist a beer truck, but people are going to heist a truck full of money or a truck full of gold or maybe $2 million with a pot.
We've got a call from Michael in Fieldbrook with a question for Anna. Go ahead. Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you, man. Hey, Anna, you're the best. Everybody should listen to this woman. She's not stupid. She's out of grasp, all right?
Hey,
I love you, and so is my beautiful wife, Cheryl. All right, Anna?
Thank you, Michael.
I just wanted to hear you on the radio.
Hey,
bye.
Buddy.
I love you. Bye.
That's not fair. That's my bass player, Michael. I paid him to do that. Well, I thought some people would call in because I was on the radio so much, and I don't think a lot of people understood why I started yelling, the sky is falling, and I was several people were really personal friends were very angry with me, and they thought I had caused the collapse of the price of marijuana because I began talking about what the actual value was, and people like to keep it a secret how much they were getting, mm-hmm. because then the buyers couldn't talk and compare.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And, well, Michael makes a point, though, that we have a lot of people in this area who have been here a long time and been associated with this business when it was still in the shadows, and now we have January 1st on the way where something's going to change.
I just don't personally experience it. Like I said, I'm really not the best person to project on it. I think it's going to be very complicated. It's going to be very messy. It's going to take an enormous amount of time. I'm sure there are a lot of people. I'm performing three nights a week. I see people with discretionary income that are involved in growing, people that are in legitimate businesses like hydroponics and medical and all of this. I see a lot of people in business, and I really, in the places I'm at, I don't have the opportunity to ask them questions about this, and it's not my place, but I imagine they must be sitting on bundles of business plans. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they got the labels and the jars and everything's in
go.
A box,
yeah,
ready
absolutely.
To ship.
Yeah.
But just getting it out of here is a big issue.
Transportation.
Getting on
be
Highway 101
issue.
Is a federal federal yeah. highways, and getting out of Humboldt for any business is a big obstacle.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm sorry, but please put the freeway in at Richardson's Grove. Stop it. Put the freeway in. We need the cheese.
That's another show. Thanks for your time, and I want to say thanks also to Dr. Dominic Korva from Seattle and Hezekiah Allen down in Sacramento.
Hezekiah!
Yeah. Larry, did you learn anything tonight?
Well, I mean, after listening to Anna's bleak outlook, I think I have concurrent Anna stress disorder.
Concurrent Anna stress disorder. Wow.
I think, the thing, as we were researching this and... Yeah. conducting the interviews, the thing that kept reoccurring that I had never really thought of very much because I didn't grow up in that community and wasn't part of it, but I heard over and over again was what Anna terms the
drug war post-traumatic stress.
And it just as I started hearing that story over and over again from various different people, I started thinking what it must have been like to live under just constant 24-hour stress, fear of camp, fear of outlaws coming and taking mm-hmm. your crop, fear of the helicopters taking your parents away.
Or your child snarking you off when they had that program in schools where the police mm-hmm. came in and told the children to turn in their parents, and then they get the kids taken away from them.
I never really had focused on that, but once you start thinking about it, it becomes manifest that, yes, that that must have been a very difficult thing to deal
Huge.
With.
Absolutely, yeah.
Everything you did, you had to worry about.
But now I have to be, I hate to be the producer, but we're up against it. We're out of time.
All right. I want to thank our sponsors, our Archaeological Research and Supply, Patrick Finnegan, CPA, The Humboldt Cure, and Eco Groovy Deals in Arcata. I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. We will be back on the third Wednesday of next month. We will see you then.